Welcome, personage of the audio spectrum, because that is where we be, living somewhere along the radio waves and sitting there. I'm picturing something like the Twilight Zone beginning, maybe, which again is nothing to do with radio waves or audios or podcasts, but I'm wandering off the garden path once more, as I should be really sticking to its gravelly underfoot to sort of welcome you to a podcast with myself, James McLean, and my colleague here, John Kenneth Muir.
Hello, James.
Hello. John Kenneth Muir, if you've not read his blog, if you've not read his books or seen any of his work, you're a writer. You're a writer on several spectrums, you know, creatively and also an analytical writer. You've looked at cult film, the gamut, really, haven't you, on sort of lens-based media, I guess.
Yes, that's right.
And also now purveyor into spaces where there are no lenses, as we had mentioned potentially last week, if these go out in order. But this week on this podcast, which we have again told you nothing about, I suppose, the equivalent of you just wandering into someone's house and awkwardly sitting down next to two middle-aged people chatting about the world of media, I guess. And I suppose that's my fault for leaving the door open and having that third chair and leaving you that chilled lemonade for you to sit down and drink while you listen to us. I take it. I own that. It's me. Sorry. But yes, we are just here to talk. And if you want to listen and talk to, that's entirely fine. Be mindful we can't hear you talk. To us, your mouth just flaps. We can't hear the words coming out. So, John, I thought that this week we would have a talk about what I decided I suppose an hour ago now, wasn't it? We would talk about, was it crunch points, did I say?
Crunch points, yes.
What's crunch point? Because you like the term, and I hadn't really paid it enough attention to realise what even the words were. Crunch point, it was a crunch point. So, crunch point, said that a few times. Yeah, what's the definition of a crunch point? We were talking before recording material, and I've talked on other podcasts a little bit about this. I imagine most podcasters or people in general talking about media as it is at the moment will be talking about this concept, which is kind of like a point where with media, something happens. It's almost like a bottleneck where the bottle starts to crack, maybe even. I'm not quite sure how dramatic a crunch point is. It sounds pretty dramatic to me. We're in a position at the moment where, my position is anyway, and you can disagree, that we have a plethora of media texts. So whether they are television, film, audio, I'd even drop video games into that as well, because they interrelate, should I say. Even books, I guess, as well. Comics. There's a lot of stuff to engage with out there, especially in terms of the film and television. We're getting to a worrying point now. And was it the Financial Times? It was one of those did recently. There's this point that there is a lot of media out there, and there's still us. You know, it's not like there's a growth in population to consume all that media and to buy it. So are we at a point coming up, a bubble burst is another term I heard a colleague of Patrick Munn a few years ago was saying to me, when's this bubble going to burst? As a journalist, that was his kind of position, because we've got so many channels now as well. We've got channels, we've got streamers, all have to be filled with content predominantly the whole time. Where do people find the time to watch that content? And then when you're monetizing that, how do you continue to monetize when people aren't able to watch all your content, and then, or even rewatch your content? Because that's a change too. If you have a series on that, has run, people might not watch it again because they've just not got time. They'll go somewhere else. So you can't even keep people on repeats like they would say, when you buy a DVD, you might watch it several times. John, do you watch things several times now? Does that happen to you?
Not often. I mean, I did, in anticipation of the second season of Strange New Worlds beginning, I did drag my wife and son back into a second viewing of the first season, which I think is very good. And we watched that twice, but that was only 10 episodes. So, I mean, I do go back. I still watch the X-Files whenever I can. I really want Millennium to stream. But, you know, I think we did a rewatch with Buffy. You know, we've done those things under the guise of introducing my son to them. So, you know, we've done all the X-Files again. We've done all of Buffy again. I've done all the Star Trek series.
Are you doing these, by the sounds of it, you're doing them through streaming platforms rather than your own collection?
Yes. I mean, I'm kind of ashamed because you know how much I love Millennium, but mm-hmm. we haven't done Millennium because I don't want to project a DVD image onto, you know, an 80-inch television or whatever, and you know, and it looked terrible, and then Joel, my son, not engage with it. You know what I mean? It's like, it's so good, it needs to look good. So it's like, wow, I haven't really introduced him to Millennium because it's not streaming. I mean, I've talked to him about it a million times, how much I love it, but we've never watched it because it's not, it, you know, it would not look good at this point. But we've gone back, we did Sapphire and Steel together. We did my son's favorite, his two favorites from all of this were, we went back and we did Twin Peaks. My son loves Twin Peaks and The Prisoner. He loves The Prisoner. He just, his mind was blown by The Prisoner and he loves The Prisoner. So, you know, he liked Firefly, liked Buffy.
But this is some of the problems, isn't it, with the crunch point, because you have, I'm going to use the term again just because we're buzzwording it, but you have this crunch between new content and enjoying old content. And again, where the, in terms of where this leads suppliers is a concern. I mean, obviously, we've seen over the last year a lot of discourse around Netflix and the trouble it's been having and how it's been responding to these problems. It's in terms of making the money that it wants to make. And I think it's actually still one of the more profitable of the lot. But this idea, again, is that even like 6 years ago, it was pretty much sharing with now, over in the UK anyway, Sky TV, Amazon Prime. There wasn't really much, but now we've obviously got a lot of new faces in the market. Certainly Paramount Plus has come on over here. There's a range of them. Even on the UK level, BritBox, ITVX is really pushing its brand more. There's just Disney, obviously. And suddenly the market share is being carved up further and further and further. And it is all paywalled as well. And yet they are all looking to make, you know, a reasonable return. And yet they are now having to either share the pool of money that's out there because people aren't suddenly going to be spending more. You've only got a certain amount of time to watch television. You can't just sort of make more hours to watch more TV. So they're having to share that sort of that pot of cash. And yet they're still having to sort of create original content or get original content created to keep them, so, you know, keep themselves viable for subscribers to want to come to them. Equally, as you say, they need to have some old shows which will bring people to them or keep them people with them if they've got those old shows with them. And, you know, the market gets carved up. So you get this whole massive contradiction of, you know, needing lots more media to keep it going. People just not having the time, not having the money to sort of spread in all these places. That to me, I kind of is where I think a crunch point is. It's like, I can't see this going anywhere good. Do you? I mean,
no, I mean, I feel, you know, really terrible about this in so many ways because, you know, I wrote a book back in 2001 and it was called like Terror Television. And like I could cover all of and it was covering all the horror TV series from like maybe 1970 to 1999. If I were to try to do that in the new millennium, like I would never finish that book. Like there's so many shows I have not gotten to and will probably never get to. For instance, I'm part of a group on Facebook. I kind of got someone asked me to be in. I said, sure, but I've never watched it. There's a show called From that a lot of people love. It's a genre, I guess, horror show, really devoted fan base. I don't even know what the show is about. I like read the post on Facebook, like, wow, this sounds interesting. Never watched it. Don't know that I'll ever watch it. Or Evil, or like they're all the like all these things are coming at me, and like they cross my radar, and then like they kind of disappear, you know. And it's like, wow, I don't even think I could, you know. It's been such an explosion of content that I don't even think I can keep track of it. I mean, I was like a Walking Dead diehard last decade. I mean, I liked it. And when everybody was hating on it, I stuck with it. Like, I stopped, like, right before they finished. And I stopped and finished the last batch of those episodes. And there was, like, three new Walking Dead shows. It's like, oh, my gosh. When am I going to get there?
I started Walking Dead during the pandemic, which was probably a bad time for my mental health to do that for myself.
I loved that. You know, I liked it better than Game of Thrones. I loved Walking Dead, and Game of Thrones just I had a hard time staying awake in, and then it kind of went off the rails, but whatever. But, you know, it's like there's so much out, there's so much content out there that I do feel like I'm missing things. And I don't feel like there's any possibility that I'm going to get there to those things. Even, you know, it took me 2 years to get to this, to the redo of Twin Peaks, the third season of Twin Peaks. It was like 2018. I think I watched that during the pandemic. And as I mentioned, we watched that with my son. We watched the first two seasons from the 90s, and we're like, oh, let's do the return. And we loved it, but it's like, wow, man, it's like, what was I waiting for? David Lynch, Kyle MacLachlan, Twin Peaks. I love it. It still took me years to get there. I just started watching The Mandalorian, you know, and then, you know, now it's going down. Wow. Yeah. There's too much, you know, and when there's too much, and I haven't seen it all, so I can't say quantitatively it's that it's all good or it's all bad or anything like that. As you say, it's too much.
It's a funny thing, because I mean, this is like 2013, mm-hmm. which is when Netflix really found its footing, when it took a few risks in terms of making some quite big shows, House of Cards and the like, and that seemed to set the ball rolling in a major way. I mean, Hulu was obviously doing it before as well, so it's not like it was brand new, but
right.
It was, that was where it's, so we've only had 10 years, and in that 10 years we have shifted from the binge TV approach, shifting to, you know, a more sustainable model, a lot of them moving back to that sort of weekly drop for main shows to keep people on subscribing so they don't drop out.
Right.
To a point, you know, where, you know, at one point it was sharing is caring, you know, in terms of passwords and accounts. And now we're now getting to a point where we can see all the major VODs sort of looking around, going, well, watching Netflix's more rigid approach to that and seeing whether it's going to work for them. So we're seeing lots of changes. And I mean, I see, and I'm sure you do as well, and without wanting to comment too much on this, you know, you see a lot of people say, oh, you know, Doctor Who, you know, Jodie Whittaker, you see how badly it's doing, and, you know, Capaldi, and, you know, it's just not the show it was, the ratings are down, no one likes it. Like, you go back to the end of Tennant, when, you know, most people said it was at its peak, some would disagree. You look what it was against then. It was nothing. There was...
Right.
The standard cable channels for you, there was Sky here for us. There was nothing particularly for Doctor Who to really fight against. Primeval in the UK for a little bit, and that was it. You know, it had not just the market share of people watching that sort of show, but it had the promotional share as well, because, you know, the people behind it, the BBC, had that, you know, it was a very easy sort of flagship to play with. But now you're in a very different world, a very murky, muddy space. It's not the same sort of world anymore.
No, and I mean, we have really too much Star Wars. I mean, I, you know, if I could tell you the number of, you know, original trilogy fans whose favorite character was Boba Fett, you know, and they grew up loving Boba Fett. They wanted Boba Fett to have his redemption after his, you know, poor showing in Return of the Jedi in 1983. So along comes Book of Boba Fett, you know. People don't watch it, and like by the last third of it, it's like The Mandalorian. You know, it's, they're bringing the characters from Mandalorian and taking it, and Boba Fett I think isn't even a significant player in some of those episodes.
I always kind of wondered whether the bits at the end with Boba Fett fighting alongside the Mandalorian, whether that was originally scripted as a Timothy Oliphant's character, because between Mandalorian episode and the last episode of Boba Fett, it just kind of feels like the show's not going in that direction. It's all about Tatooine, and it would make far more sense for that last two episodes to have the Marshal, Timothy Oliphant's Marshal character with Boba Fett at the end, rather than taken out. Again, it's this whole thing about why would they do that? And again, it comes down to this push of material, isn't it?
Right. I mean, you can, you know, you can't sustain that. You know, I don't think Andor was really well rated, but it was very good. I really liked
it.
I thought it was outstanding, and I try to tell people, oh, really, watch this. But, like, you know, now when you say that to people, watch this, people are like, yeah, that's like 10 down on my list, dude. You know, it's like, you know, there's just too much. You know, as we record this, you know, Star Trek Discovery has been canceled. Star Trek Picard is over. Star Trek Prodigy was just canceled. So that's just leaving us with Strange New Worlds and Lower Decks. So it's like, wow, okay, not only is there probably too much Star Wars, but maybe there was too much Star Trek for it to be profitable. You know, we're in a the crunch point that you're talking about here is this, you know, oversaturation of things. You know, my blog, I'll be honest, and this isn't going to get at any readers, but like its heyday was probably up to about 2013, because my thing was kind of, I mean, I still blog and you can still see stuff there, but my thing was kind of like, I'm championing these things that didn't get seen, like that we don't have anymore. Like maybe we could have some more Twin Peaks. So let's look at that. Or maybe we need more Firefly. Or maybe, you know, there's this, that, other thing. Like now we live in a world where we've gotten all those things. And like my voice, you know, it isn't really tuned to those. We live in a world of such plenty where we've had Mystery Science Theater come back, Veronica Mars has come back, Twin Peaks has come back, Star Trek has come back, Star Wars has come back, Marvel has asserted itself in, you know, this huge way. And it's like, you know, my whole sort of thing was, it's like, hey, look at these things. The X-Files has come back. Look at these things that were so good. And I think there was still some juice in them, you know? And now it's like, wow, they've all been back. It's like, wow, what am I going to write about?
It was a television scholar, John Ellis. I think he sort of had to like the era of scarcity. You didn't have everything you wanted television. And he had several eras. And, you know, then it gets eventually to sort of like the era of, as you say, plenty or abundance. But you get to a point where you get to, you're in an area of, I don't know, suffocation almost, where there's just, you know, so much of the stuff that you would want to see. That's the difference. It's not just like, say, the 2000s, where you just had so much you could watch 24 hours, 24/7. You're now in a point where everything you would like to watch is 24/7.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of that line in Star Trek. You know, Spock says, you know, having is not so great a thing as wanting. It's like, wow, I feel like, you know, I've been hoisted upon my own, like, sort of creative petard here. So I wanted more of those things. You know, I wanted, you know, more Star Trek, more X-Files, more than, it's like, and now that I've gotten so much, like, it's like I'm choking on them, right? It really is. It's like, and now I want less of all those things.
So,
crazy.
Because there's an interesting thing, because there used to be the thing where people talked about cash cows, and this being an idea that, you know, that you'd have an IP, which you would then, the term milk to death by just doing reiterations of it. Of it was normally done pejoratively, that it was about it having diminishing returns, that you know, you were just draining it just purely for the IP. You know, cash cows now seem to have a different kind of meaning, because if you look at, and I know there will be people listening to this who will disagree, but I would still say that Star Wars has not been milking. A lot of what it's done has been very good stuff. It's not been substandard stuff. Now, I know there'll be people who disagree with that, but ultimately, my point being is, whether you do or not, that the cash cowing has got to a point where it's almost like it's not done in a way which is to drain a series. It's done in a way to extend a series, and by doing so, you've got to do it with quality. And so that's what they've been doing. But there comes a point where, does that become, using a term used earlier, I think, hoisted by your own petard, where you end up just strangling the energy and interest out of people? And I know people have been saying this for a few years with Marvel, and I'm beginning to wonder whether there is a truth to that.
Yeah, I mean, Marvel and DC, I mean, no one was interested in The Flash, and people can point to the troubles with the Star, they can point to, you know, whatever, but I mean, the Flash had been on TV for how many years? Yeah. A different actor playing The Flash. So, you know, it's like, does every superhero need a huge blockbuster movie? Like, what is my impetus to go see The Flash? Oh, Michael Keaton is in it, so that's it, huh? So the highest thing you can call me to is nostalgia for a 35-year-old movie, you know, and that's almost enough, because I really like Michael Keaton. But
getting very good vibes, very good, you know, before it was being released, and, you know, the previews, people going, this is a brilliant film, this is the best superhero film I've seen. And yet,
so here's the thing, like, I haven't seen it, so I can't say it wasn't good or was good. But I'm saying, what you're saying is a really interesting point, is that it tracked well. Apparently, it was very well made, was very good. And so what's happening is that something, even something that's very good. So we're not talking about, you know, Black Adam or Justice League or something like, even something like, it's like, let's say in the upper tier of that genre, right, is not pulling people in. Even something, you know, if you go back to like, I know it's a long time ago, but the 90s, Scream. Okay, Scream kind of came out of nowhere. Good word of mouth, stayed in the theaters forever because people liked it. Right, because it was good. It found its voice, and it stayed and became this, you know, big surprise horror hit that really changed the course of horror for, you know, 15 years. So, but now you get something which was publicized to the hilt, The Flash, you know, made for fan. It's got all of these fan servicey things. Good word of mouth. And you can't pay people money to go see that thing. It made less than Black Adam. So you got to ask yourself, what is the crunch point here? What is going on where people are like, you know, hey, it might be good, but I cannot be bothered to go. And I mean, I've seen so many, you know, articles saying, well, what is it? Well, it's like, it's not special anymore because they know it's going to be on streaming in a couple weeks. I believe that. I have not gone, again, kind of ashamed. I didn't go to see Avatar 2 in the theater, even though it was 3D, and I know it wouldn't be 3D when I brought it. It's like, I just couldn't, you know, it wasn't enough for me to go there, you know, and I like James Cameron. John Wick 4, no, I still haven't seen it. It's like, I know it's all out there and I'm going to get to it, but I'm just going to get to it in the comfort of my home. I think that the ready availability of these things on streaming has made it so that theater going is, shoot, it's too much trouble. Right? You know, it's almost too much trouble to go, you know, and for something like that, it's like, how many superhero movies have I seen? Even if Flash is like the best one, do I want to go? Is it going to equal the experience of Endgame or whatever?
First off, crunch point sounds like a perfect DC comic moment. It feels like one of those those special event things, but there's so many garden paths here that I'm looking at that we could talk about, because it's just a massively fascinating space. Because I think also, as much as people don't want to talk about it that much for obvious reasons, but I mean, pandemic, no issues with going to the cinema now. But, you know, for a while when the pandemic was on, I was kind of a bit aware of that space. But then that was the time when, you know, the streaming capitalized on that and started putting things on, as you say, premiering or co-premiering or coming on very soon after, especially right. The Disney model. I think you're right. I think a lot of the times with those sort of films, even the thought of going to the cinema now, I would, if it wasn't potentially going to come on streaming, maybe. But then does that mean, I'm not an accountant, but is there a problem in the sort of metric that is being used to assess the financial viability of these films and shows? I mean, obviously they need to make money quick because they've cost a lot of money. So
right.
There's a need to make sure that those who put money in are rewarded as those who put in are expecting to be rewarded. But ultimately, right. If the reason I say, you know, I didn't go to see Quantumania was because I knew it would be on Disney Plus. If the reason that I've stayed on Disney Plus paying that subscription to Disney is partially because of that. They've made money through that.
That's true.
Film by me knowing it's going to be there and being one of the, not the only reason, but one of the reasons which keeps me from swapping to a Paramount Plus. So is there something about the way that they analyze the success of these films?
I think so. And I mean, I think that, you know, I don't think they have ever come up with a business model that takes into account what we can do through the internet, either through journalism, like the New York Times. That's why we've had so many failed, news platforms, or movies and television. I don't think we have ever come up with a business model that can sustain these things. I mean, again, some people will disagree with me. I really did like the last Star Trek movie, Star Trek Beyond. it made some ridiculous amount of money where, you know, you and I would look at that and say it made whatever, $350-400 million. And we'd be like, ah, you know, wow. You know, but, you know, it had to make $1 billion, right? It's like, dude, how many Star Trek fans do you think there are, right? You know, why – you know, until the tools of the film, until we can make you know, in Star Trek, the motion picture was very expensive. It was like the most expensive picture of all time, I think, when it came out in 1979, but it was $40 million. So now, but now to make anything like a tentpole movie, you're talking $300-400 million.
I mean, I'd be interested to know how much of that is to do with the actual cost, how much of it is to do with how much of that profit margin has is now that certain levels of anticipation for people to put for the money to go in for what it comes out.
Yeah. That needs to be re-examined. I mean, I'm sorry to say it. And, you know, again, I'm going to sound like such an old cantankerous person here, which I really try not to. But it's like, you know, a Star Trek movie, you know, you get that beautiful, charismatic cast. I really like the cast for the Kelvin movies. You put them in another movie that's got like three or four really terrific science fiction ideas in it and strong, some kind of strong character arc. It's like, can you not do that for 80 or 100 million even? You know what I'm saying? It's like, wow, like Star Trek is about ideas. So it's like, gosh, we need to start kind of pushing it back into this idea of like, hey, I want to do a Star Trek movie that's really about ideas, and it will be thrilling because of the idea and what happens to the characters, not about, you know, what kind of special effects can we throw into this thing, you know? And I think that, you know, I think that's going to have to be the model for Marvel. It's going to have to be the model for Star Wars, because these are aging franchises. People feel like they've seen it all before. And, you know, what we need is a reinvigorating of the writing. And, you know, writers are obviously on strike, but they are the only people, I think, who can save us from this. Because, you know, as long as it's all just a matter of like, how much money can I throw at Star Trek to make more money, or Star Wars or whatever, it's going to be diminishing returns. That is a crunch point too, which is, I think that, you know, you're seeing that, like, I mean, when you look at these movies that are $300-400 million to make, I read something that said Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny was like $350 million to make, and that wasn't even including advertising. Who the hell do they think is going to? How many people do they think are going to see that thing? Right? I mean, you've set that movie up to fail, and I love Harrison Ford and Indiana Jones. I'm trying to get my son to the theater. I've seen every Indiana Jones movie in the theater, but he doesn't want to go. You know, I just think that there's a problem there if that's what it costs to make a blockbuster. I mean,
is it also? I mean, you know, one of the basic fundamentals of making any sort of form of creative media, as you know, certainly from personal experience as well, is that obviously you have very high upfront costs in terms of making it. But right. Sort of in theory, by comparison, very low distribution costs at the other end. So all the risk is up front, and then of course you're placing it to a market where creative and cultural tastes are shifting all the time. So it can be very hard to predict what they're going to like and what they're not going to like, which can right. sort of be a worry as well when you've obviously had to put so much money into it. And the whole idea of you throw so much against the wall and you're waiting for the one to stick and make the money which covers the costs of the losses that you might make on the others.
Right.
And if that's the case, if that's still kind of an issue here, media markets exploding in a way, is some of those risks having to be factored in and bolstering the need for these bigger ones to make their return?
I think that is happening, you know, and I think one genre we can look at, ironically, which has succeeded through this whole time is horror. You look at something like Barbarian or Smile or whatever, you know, those are films that don't cost a lot. they're usually some kind of high concept thing. They don't cost a lot. They create buzz. And they turn, you know, a pretty good profit. You know, horror has been able to succeed in this time in a way like, you know, Black Adam, The Flash, they'll never be profitable. Or if so, so many years down the road, whatever. But, you know, horror movies, you know, you do know in the first week that they've made back their money and more, right? Because they tend to be lower budgeted. I mean, I think, you know, I know nobody wants to hear that, but I think we have to sort of temper these kind of things. I mean, to say, listen, we can't spend this $350 million on this, on the Flash. Now, can we spend $350 million on Superman? Yeah, that's a better bet. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, who has the cultural currency? Did you know who Black Adam was, really? Like, did you like really know who Black Adam was, or before the movie? How many people knew that? It's like, well, it's The Rock. Okay, so people are going to go to see The Rock, right? Well, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think people felt like they'd seen it before. You know, they'd seen it, you know, six times before, you know, no matter who's fronting it. So, I do think there are films out there and genres out there which can thrive in this market, horror specifically. But, you know, I just don't think you can keep throwing hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, pardon me, DC and Marvel, but at second tier superhero movies, you know, and I'm sorry for The Flash. I know probably so many people love The Flash, and that's wonderful. You know, very successful on television. Great. But, you know, who's then going to turn around and, you know, rush to opening weekend of that movie?
I suppose, again, it depends on how much the industry, like I said, is it just making sheer profits through these big blockbusters, or are they costing that much, or are they subsidizing other areas of a burgeoning and bloating industry? But, you know, in terms of things like, you know, cancellations, you know, I always thought once we got to 2013 and there was no longer any, you know, ads and commercials to be highly dependent on whether a show continues or not, depending on how the ratings in relation to those ads were playing, you know, whether they were premium or not. I thought, yeah, we wouldn't see any cancellations anymore because you were no longer behest to advertisement.
But, right.
And again, you kind of feel like as soon as you've got cancellations like that, it kind of suggests that it's an industry which isn't just burgeoning with money, that it gets scared as soon as there is a risk of something is counterintuitive to where they're going. It has to be removed, no matter where it is in its, you know, franchise cycle.
I think that's totally true. I mean, there was some article a couple months ago where the person, you know, I guess it was a Disney over Star Wars and Indiana Jones and Marvel. They basically said, we got to cut this way back because it's not, you know, it's just not possible to do this much and turn a profit. And, you know, and they were talking about their streaming ventures for sure. And, you know, that kind of like trickled down then to like, people say, well, if Disney's saying this, you know, Paramount Plus must be dealing with this. Mm-hmm. And then, like, sure enough, we trickle down and we get like, okay, Prodigy's gone, First Discovery was gone, you know, and it's like, okay, you know, it's funny. You know, my wife and I argue all the time about, you know, the stock market. And, you know, I said, well, you know, the stock market is really like, you know, basically a rich person putting their finger in the wind and saying, I feel that this doesn't, you know, I feel bad about how things are going. Right? You know, and as soon as the one person says that, you know, somebody else puts their finger in the wind and says, I also feel bad about how things are going. Right. And, yeah. And then suddenly we have a stock market crash. Right. And this crunch point, I feel like, you know, and I mean, it is a crunch point. We have just this oversaturation of media, but it's like, you know, and I guess it just to shows you how vulnerable, you know, media is to this, is that, you know, one person sticks their finger up and says, we can't continue doing this. You know, then we learn someone else is, you know, we can't continue doing this either, you know, and it's going to be a cascade of this. It's like, you know, then, you know, and with Netflix, as you said, cracking down on the sharing policy, it's like they're looking for any means to try to stay afloat. But you just have to wonder too how much of this is, you know, people looking and saying, you know, how much profit is not enough profit, how much profit is enough profit, how much of an appetite do people have for, you know, Flash and WandaVision and Moon Knight, you know. And
the thing that needs to change in terms of streaming is that there's got to be a way of having consumers easily tap into different paywalled spaces. Otherwise, these paywalled spaces are going to surely just start isolating themselves out and making money. And yes, the smaller ones will go first.
To quote Fight Club, this is single serving television. You know, I watch one thing on Paramount Plus and I pay for that. But then I want to see this thing on Hulu and then I pay for that. And then Peacock has this show that I like. So, you know, I mean, cable TV, I mean, I'm not a fan, but like, you know, you'd pay and you'd get it all. You know, and there was probably too much. You know, there are channels I never watched. Yeah, so it was ridiculous. But you sort of got, you had a good chance of having what you wanted under that umbrella of cable television, as opposed to streaming being this single serving thing. You know, which it's like, okay, so if I want, you know, I am both a Star Trek fan and a Star Wars fan. Wow. So, you know, do I have to choose between Disney and Paramount Plus, or am I going to have both? You know, the X-Files, that's at home on Hulu, and there's that great show there, The Bear, I think it's called, in the diner. It's like, I want to watch that. So I better have Hulu. I mean, I can't tell you know, how many of these platforms I have, and it adds up very quickly. And it's you know, I've gone through, you know, periods of like canceling them all except a few, and then like re-upping with them, because then it's like, then we're out of stuff to watch if you get rid of too many, right? You know, it's like, oh my gosh, we got rid of HBO Max, and that's where Succession was, and I really want to watch Succession, so now we have to get onto Max. Now it's not HBO Max anymore.
Because that's the danger, isn't it? But doing this sort of slow rollout global policy of making sure it's only household onlys can have access to a subscription. The idea is that the people that knocks off will go on and buy Netflix. They'll go, okay, I can no longer use my friend's password, I will go and buy it myself. Right. But when you have a market which is no longer dominated as it was, say, 6 years ago, and there are other options out there, the guarantee that they will go and do that isn't necessarily there. You will also have people who will leave you because they feel affronted, because they've been with you for like 8 years. Now you've suddenly said, well, the way you use it is no longer how we want it to be. So we want you to have the same service for either paying more or a lesser service to pay less. And they back out. Do people naturally come back? And the other the factor there is, do you have the content to make them come back? Especially if you are a library service, which is what these streamers tend to be. And by this point, 10 years later, they watched most of your original content already.
Right.
Have you the incentive to bring them back in, or are they either going to go away or suddenly realize a cheaper cable option or a cheaper subscription is just better for them anyway? And because there's so much material out there, they know they can't see everything anyway. So it gets to a point where it's like, well, I don't need to see Strange New Worlds. I can do without seeing season 4 of Stranger Things. You know, I can cope with it because I've got other things to watch.
Yes. I mean, I think that's true. I mean, I really like Stranger Things, and I never went back to the fourth season of it, right? Which people loved. I read all about it. I'm sure it was great. You know, people seem to really like it. But yeah, exactly. You start to make like decisions based on both your time and your economics. You know, and it's kind of crazy because, you know, HBO Max just changed to Max. And of course, it wasn't a seamless transition. So to get to Max, like, you have to like sign up and all this stuff, for me anyway. And it's like, they gave you three tiers. And the second tier was like, you can watch it on two devices. Well, I've got three TVs in my house. And that was the third tier. And that was like $7 more. Exactly. Like, oh man, you know, it's like, wow. Okay. So now you're monitoring not just who is watching, but you're saying like, I can't, if I have multiple televisions, it's going to cost me more. Cause I have sort of one in the family room where my wife and I hang out, one in the rec room, which is pretty much my son's room, but we watch movies there. And then we have one in our bedroom. Like, I want to have it on three devices. Cause I don't know which device, where I'm going to be. My wife might be watching Masterpiece Theater on one. My son might be playing video games on the other. And I might want to watch Max on the third TV. Well, now that's going to cost me $7 more a month to use a third television in my house. I mean, you know, and of course, this is a way, as you're saying, to try to control costs and to be able to continue to make enough stuff to feed this beast, right?
Yeah.
But it's unsustainable. I mean, it's unsustainable. You know, I don't know. I guess we're watching Yellow Jackets on HBO now. So maybe, you know, but after we finish the second season, I might drop that and not come back. Cause I don't know that I want to pay that every month, $19.99 or whatever it is every month.
Must have been other crunch points that we can look back to and say, okay, they're very different, but, you know, where were they, or where was that sort of buzz of where they were? I mean, certainly, I mean, obviously, you know, things like cable was obviously a big one for you guys.
Right. You know, I think that, you know, a major crunch point in television history, which people don't talk enough about, but I mean, it made Star Trek a cultural phenomenon was, you know, in the early 70s, the rules governing syndication
and
the idea that the networks would not control everything. So suddenly you had, you know, Gerry Anderson shows like Space 1999, new expensive top of the line science fiction drama, you know, being syndicated. The Star Lost was another of that. You know, there was this move. And then, of course, Star Trek The Next Generation, when it came around, didn't go to a network, did it? It premiered in syndication. And you had that, you know, phase with The Untouchables, War of the Worlds, Freddy's Nightmares, all of these syndicated shows, shows that could be made like outside sort of the mainstream taste and outside of the gatekeeping of networks. I think that was kind of a crunch point as well. You know, so that would have been in the 70s and sort of late 80s, you know, because there were cultural, moral issues about that. It's like, I mean, I remember there was some poll that was taken in the United States when Freddy's Nightmares was on in syndication that said like more 6-year-olds recognized Freddy Krueger than they did Abraham Lincoln, you know. It's like, you know, people freaked out, you know, oh no, right? This is so terrible, you know. It's like, oh, but it was a way of getting past gatekeepers and people creating something that they felt there was a appetite for, and there was. So, you know, that would be one. Cable TV, certainly. Right. I mean, in 1975, you know, everyone was saying it was like the worst batch of network shows in history. It was like terrible shows that, you know, getting awful reviews. Nobody wanted to watch them. And that's when Space 1999 came into syndication. And it succeeded, you know, this patchwork thing going to 120 different stations across the United States. And it was like finishing first in Washington, D.C. and second in New York City, you know, beating out the networks. It was like this glorious moment there for a minute where it's like, oh my gosh, we're not going to have the gatekeepers. We're not going to be limited to these three options, you know, CBS, ABC, and NBC. You know, these shows are so bad that, you know, those networks, they replace, I mean, those stations, pardon me, the stations that aired those shows in syndication, they replaced the bad shows. Like, instead of airing, you know, that horrible McClure Shatner show, Barbary Coast, they put Space 1999, they defied the network and put Space 1999 there in prime time in that slot. And it drew a bigger audience. I mean, that was a really interesting point in television history.
It's giving a sort of almost like a regional power as well in determining sort of content, but right. Also quality, which initially was considered to be not perceived as so much as a threat as it could become. That was part of the crunch point as well from your mind.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, and at that point, you know, Paramount began thinking about saying, oh my gosh, we need to create a fourth network and Star Trek will be the flagship. You know, before Star Trek became Star Trek the Motion Picture, it was going to come back. Well, ask yourself, what happened between 1969 when Star Trek went off the air and when they were looking at their fourth network? What happened? Where? It was that syndication thing. You had shows like Star Lost in syndication in 73, Space 1999 in 75. And they're always like, oh my gosh, it's like, wow, the studio can go. They don't need ABC, NBC, CBS. The studio can go and like distribute this, get this in syndication, and they're not beholden to networks, you know, whims to cancel things or whatever, or to not go with a show like Star Trek, right? Which obviously was very popular, yet, you know, Star Trek couldn't get arrested on TV, you know, on a network, you know, one of the greatest shows of all time, you know, limped through three seasons, right? And the irony of that, of course, is that any show that got Star Trek's ratings today would be considered the greatest hit in all times, or of all times, wouldn't it, right?
Because that's also one of the major curses of this era of such saturated content. And again, people will have different opinions on this, but, you know, I see, like, with the conversations of the new sort of Daisy Ridley Ray Star Wars movies, 2025, 2026, coming out, and the comments around that, or as you say, Mandalorian season 3. And I look back and I think, yeah, Star Wars was a brilliant film, and Empire Strikes Back was an amazing film. Return of the Jedi, you could put these days, you know, it doesn't feel like the other two.
No, I'm not a fan of Return of the Jedi, actually.
As a kid, I was, but as an adult, it was not the best film at all.
Right.
But because there was so little else to compare it with, it kind of stands on its own in its own way, because the only thing you had to compare it with was Empire Strikes Back and Star Wars. And I don't think anyone ever said A Return of the Jedi is better than those two films, but I find it's quite a mess of a film. And in some ways, that's its charm. Its mess is a bit of a charm, but it is, you know, you could almost like split it into six parts, put it on after the Book of Boba Fett, and it would fit in quite nicely. It would feel the spiritual sister brother to Empire Strikes Back and Star Wars is obviously Rogue One.
I love Rogue One.
Which would fit. I mean, obviously, chronologically, it wouldn't, but it would fit in tone with the other two films. And yet, that's a Disney, that was a Disney
movie. Right.
So yeah, Empire Strikes Back was great. Star Wars was great. Caravan of Courage, Battle of Endor, Droids, Star Wars Christmas Special. You can start seeing that, the quality throughout that period ain't great, really. But because the way that everything is distributed and those smaller things just disappear into the ether, you're only left remembering those big three and big three against nothing else, because there's nothing else to compare them with.
Right. Absolutely. And I mean, I think that, you're also, in terms of Star Wars and even Return of the Jedi, it's just the rose colored glasses. I mean, I always say, gosh, thank God the internet was not around, when Star Wars premiered or Star Trek premiered, because they would have ended and, people would have complained about them, so bad.
But I mean, if you go back to a period, you look in 1980, look at some of the, comments and reviews about Empire. They weren't all great.
No, they were not.
People don't always, and interestingly enough, you take the prequels, nowadays, they have a certain cultural leverage now because there were kids who grew up on them. And even people like me who didn't particularly like them, seeing Hayden Christensen come back in Kenobi was a delight. It was great to see him and Ewan McGregor face off again and have a moment to actually... Yeah, so, time does... And I'm sure, as we're aware with Doctor Who, at one point, Sylvester McCoy era was, the bane of the period. And now is seen as one of those golden eras of Doctor Who, with the, Ghostlight and Curse of Fenric. So time does change those. But again, I think, as you say, because this crunch point is very different, although at the same time, you talking about syndication, there are echoes there in terms of an industry caught off foot. Yeah.
But, I think the difference is, though, and I often think about this, is so many choices means that, I won't encounter something that, when we had fewer choices, even with syndication, there was a good chance I was going to encounter the X-Files, or there was a good chance I was going to encounter Firefly, or Star Trek, or whatever, Space 99, Buffy, whatever. Like that was like a reasonable expectation, like that I was going to find it. And like if I were in a room with 10 people, four or five of them were going to find it too. I feel really, I don't know if you want to call it balkanization or whatever, but there's this sort of fracturing where it's like now, I mean, I'm asked all the time, did you watch Loki or WandaVision? It's like, no, but you're a geek, you're like geek prince, right? I'm like, I know, but I haven't watched it. It's like now you get people in a room. It's like, maybe, okay, nobody I worked with watched any Star Trek Discovery, I don't know if they're watching Strange New Worlds, but it's like now you're in the room, those 10 people, like no one's watching what you're watching. Maybe one or two if you're lucky. And the way these things like Star Wars obviously have thrived is by being so successful and so big that they became cultural shorthand. Same thing with Star Trek, right? And now, like, is anything gonna ever be cultural shorthand? Are we ever gonna have that union where it's like we all saw Jaws 48 summers ago, or if we were alive, right? Or we became aware of it through television broadcasts of it, and then we rented it on DVD, whatever. We became aware of that thing that was big enough for us to be aware it was a thing. Now, will I ever watch The Flash? I don't know. There are too many other things ahead of it. So that's never going to enter, the shorthand, even the way something like Big Trouble in Little China or Buckaroo Banzai have. You see what I'm saying? Because there was still a certain level of mass in that mass media. Now the mass media has gotten so small. I don't know that I'll ever watch From or Evil or whatever. Yeah. It's like kind of random, right?
I found on, I think it was ITVX, or one of them over here, suddenly found hidden in the bottom of the catalogue of Space 1999. And I started watching one of the second season. I mean, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, I'd probably watch it all. But because it's just so much other things to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, there's so many things on the pile. So one of the things I just thought we might end with, and you use a term about, I'm going to use it differently, but I like the term you talk about, unionizing, in terms of socializing in watching the same sort of thing. Being over the 23 years, I'm going to go with that, although you can go back further. There has been that sort of understanding that a way to keep an audience is to interconnect your material. So, you know, Doctor Who was obviously doing it with Torchwood, Sarah Jane Adventures, interconnections. A little bit there was with Carter's Lock, since we talk about them sometimes, Millennium, Lone Gunman, X-Files. Right. But certainly as soon as you get, as soon as Disney really clocks it with the Marvel films, and then that is also applied to Star Wars, and DC has fumbled its way of trying to do this as well. This idea that right. you perpetuate people within your IP by continually making sure everything is interlinked, and so therefore you really need to watch everything else to actually understand where you're at. If that is part of the erosion of energy, are we at a point where we need to be de-unionizing franchise material?
My answer to that is yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, Solo was not well received. It's come up in estimation since it was received.
Yeah, it has, isn't it?
It has. I took my dad to it. My dad is now 79. He took me to see Star Wars when I was in second grade. So he's in the know. But we saw the sequel trilogy as well. You know, we've seen all the Star Wars movies together. But we came out of Solo, and he's like, I love that. That's my favorite Star Wars movie in years. And I said, why? And he said, because I didn't have to know anything. He said, I didn't have to know who anybody was, or where they were connected, or what time period this was. He said, it was just this sort of, you know, love story with Han Solo and Emilia Clarke's character, can't remember her name. It was a heist and a love story and a gangster story. And it was like, he said that, you know, I didn't have to remember who was whose son and who was, you know, in what organization and, you know, all this. He said, it was all very clear to me. And he said, I just really had a good time with it. And I think the de-unionizing of things is probably a good idea. Like, do you want to connect to, did you want the next Batman movie to connect to The Flash or some other less successful movie? I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, something like Star Trek has always kind of had that internal connection. You know, one of the things I always respected about the Next Generation is that the Ferengi weren't really very successful at first, but then they kept bringing the Ferengi back, and like they figured it out. They didn't just ditch the Ferengi, right? So that, you know, there's a difference between sort of the continuity and then just like connecting everything, if that makes sense. So I'm a big fan of continuity, but not a big fan of necessarily like this, you know, people call it fan service. I don't know if it's fan service, but of like bringing in like everything. It's like, we're bringing in the Michael Keaton Batman, here comes the George Clooney Batman. It's like, but is there a reason for them to be there? I'm happy if there's a reason to be there.
Back when, say, Star Trek, Next Generation was doing it, and I know you know this, so I'm just pointing it out to others. Obviously, as you say, syndicated, as you were saying earlier, there is a deliberate need to make sure that there is not a massive amount of continuity running through, enough that writers can get away with, but ultimately, you know, there's that desire that things can be separated out, shown in different order and under different schedules. So, you know, you don't want to, you make things stand alone for a very sort of distribution-tied reason. But now are you in a position where you've got to be kind of doing the same thing, but not for a sort of economic distribution, but almost for like a creative dispersal, almost, so that people can not feel like they have to watch everything to the point where they just back off and go, I can't watch any of it, and will actually dip in without feeling that they need to have had to dip in with everywhere else. So that model has to almost like change for sort of artistic reasons. Well, no, it's not artistic reasons, because it's still commercial, isn't it?
It is. But, you know, Strange New Worlds, which I like very much, it's a breath of fresh air because it tends to be more standalone-ish. And now, yeah, I mean, it's more like the original Star Trek, where it's like one week you'll really like the story, but the next week it's a totally new story. You know, but the, you know, something in that standaloneness gives it the freedom to fail. I think we're all exhausted culturally with these intertwined 8 to 10 part stories where it's got to sustain one story, and you know, and it's all undercut if they don't stick the landing. I mean, look at the remade Battlestar Galactica. It didn't stick the landing. And like, you know, people still remember it fondly, but it's kind of disappeared from the cultural discussion to a large degree. Look at Game of Thrones and how far that's fallen because they didn't stick the landing. You know, if you have this one huge story and like, for instance, if you say like the Cylons have a plan and you're saying that every week, the Cylons have a plan, the Cylons have a plan. When you get to the end and the Cylons don't have a plan, you know, you have the right to be pissed off as a viewer and be like, oh, screw this. I'm never watching this again. Same thing like with Lost, you know, which again seemed to have no end game, you know, but appeared that it was headed somewhere. And then you found out they have no idea where they're going. Or Game of Thrones, you know, having to get ahead of the source material, coming up with something that pleased nobody. So it's like the stakes are so high with serialized storytelling. You know, you stake your whole season on this one story, you better stick the landing. I mean, it's, and you know, Rise of Skywalker, it's the same thing, that the sequel trilogy, like it or hate it. It's like there was clearly no plan. And so by the time you got to that movie, it's like, man, this is bad. This is bad because there was clearly never a plan going in. Whereas a standalone, it's like, I'm going to go in for 50 minutes. Captain Pike and the Enterprise are going here this week. I really like this story. Or conversely, ooh, I don't like this one. But, you know, I'll try it again next week because it will be something different. And I don't have to sort of invest in this slowly building thing where they just feed me a little breadcrumb every week until they get to the end. But by the time they get to end, I don't think they remember where they began, because don't they remember they said this or this? You know, it's, you know, I think serialized storytelling has been really – bad for television, and it's been done very poorly. It's been done very poorly in most cases. Some not so much, but you know, certainly in terms of genre, you've got to say, like, I mean, the solutions people come up with, and again, they seem to by week 10 not remember where they were in week 2. You know, it just, as opposed to the standalone stuff, like the Strange New Worlds. But
I've always said you can always have a bad beginning or a bad middle, but you can never have the bad end. I can't think of many that have had good endings. Interesting enough, the Picard season 3. Did you actually watch Picard season 3?
I did.
I enjoyed it. I watched it with family each week, and I enjoyed it. But I felt the continuity aspect of it tiring.
I felt absolutely
that fatigue, and while a lot of people loved the last two episodes, I didn't as much. But at the same time, in terms of having a sort of satisfying conclusion to that story, was like a beginning episode or two at most that set up Picard, Riker, Picard's son Beverly on board the Titan, and then maybe have something at the end which finishes that journey, but the rest in between just to be standalones.
I
don't need to have this ongoing mystery box thing playing out. I just don't think it's always, it's become an easy television trick, and I don't think it's wholly satisfying.
You know, I mean, not to damn it with faint praise, but I think, you know, the third season was better than the early two seasons.
Oh, God, yes, absolutely.
But I also, you know, have this part of my brain where it was like pinging, like, this is appealing to me, not on story idea, not on, you know, good writing, but on my nostalgic desire to see these characters on their old ship again and to give them a nice finish. And I'd like, is there anything wrong with that? No, there isn't. I'm glad they, you know, after Nemesis, I'm glad they finally got their lovely ending. I thought Flakes was terrific as Riker in this. Like, I just enjoyed the heck out of him the whole season. But like, I felt like the whole thing was bloated and never knew where it was going and never kind of came into focus until like the last two, and when you realize sort of what the end game of the show was.
But I think what was bugging me, what we've been seeing over since, well, Buffy's the one that springs most to my mind for it, the move towards the end enemy, who's been peppered throughout season.
Right, the big bad, right.
And it's and it's moving to that. So you have all these sort of one-off stories, which is slowly pushing you towards this inevitability of this big end game. And I just think that's become so boring. And I think it's just so unneeded. And I kind of feel that those last two episodes could have actually been more special if they'd stripped back some of the big scale stuff, the Borg, the taking over of the fleet, all that, if that was stripped away and it became a far more personalized story about the son, the father, the crew, and a need to get to come back on that ship together, united as one.
Right.
And one final nitpicky, because I've never had anyone else to say this to, because no one else will listen to me on this. I really felt on the Enterprise D, they needed some corridor shots. They could have just taken them from stock. They just needed something, because to me, it almost felt like there was that one set, the bridge, which they'd done immaculately. But I didn't get the feeling of the ship. And it just needed a couple of shots, you know, when it was rattling around, when it's being hit, just to show. And they say, I'm sure they could have pulled that from archive, just to make it feel like it was a big space rather than just a bridge set. But anyway, that's me. Sorry, John, carry on.
No, I mean, I totally get it. You know, I do feel that the series, the third season, started out very slow and then became rushed at the end. Like, I don't feel like I ever felt like the pacing was sort of exactly right. I felt it was either too slow or too fast. And, but I mean, you know, I love seeing Enterprise D. I would have loved to see Corridors too, to see a little bit more, but I know budgetary constraints, I'm sure, was the reason why. But they could have used archive for sure, or blue screen over archive or something.
I just think that when the ship gets hit, you could just go to one of the many shots of a corridor and just rattle the image. And that would just give you a feeling that that is an empty ship with just them on top.
This may not be a popular opinion, but I found one of the most moving moments in the entire show was a very simple one. It was the one where Seven of Nine was on the bridge, and she said that she sort of grew up or something on Voyager, and the Voyager theme kicked in, and she said that it was her family. And it was just like this lovely little character moment that put her journey into context. And I thought, oh, that's so nice. And it is a moment of fan service in a way, because we're looking at Voyager, we're hearing the theme, but it was also a very true moment for Seven's character, I think, and let us know, like, what have you been doing for 20 years, you know? It's sort of like, oh yeah, this, you know, that was still a fond place in her heart. That seemed like a very, like, individual and human moment inside this big mystery box, which, you know, I love that you call that, because I think it's very much that, you know, and, you know, I read all the reviews and everybody raved and bawled and cried. And I'm like, yeah, I get it too. But there's that part of me, my brain starts ringing when they're, you know, someone's trying to play too hard on my nostalgia stuff. It's like not if there's other stuff there, but like if there's not enough there and they're just trying to hit me on the nostalgia, I start to feel manipulated a little bit. You know, and the things that kept that from overwhelming me were, again, Frake's performance. I thought he was so dynamic and fun and amusing and colorful in this role in ways we really had not seen him be before.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and that scene where he told that episode where he told Picard to get off the bridge that he'd killed him, I thought that was great.
Yeah, absolutely.
He gave Riker teeth. He gave him a sense of humor. Fantastic for Riker. Like, oh my God, Riker, look at you. You're fantastic, John Frakes.
I think we're probably going to have to tie this up, because I feel like we could go on forever on this subject, because it is a bit of a non-subject, because like Crunch Point, so many things ramming together here. I can't kind of make sense of where it's going. I think maybe far more than things like syndication or the introduction of video or, you know, cable satellites. The way the industry is now and the way it has so intertextually tied itself to film as well. So it's kind of dragging it along too.
Right. Yeah. So there's going to have to be a new paradigm, but maybe we can talk about what would that paradigm look like at some point.
Yeah, there's just loads. See where it all goes, maybe, and we'll come back to it and see where we all are.
Yeah, we get to live right on the frontier of this time, James. So we'll get to see what's next and where we're headed. And, you know, maybe we'll look back and say, was this a crunch point, or is the crunch point yet to come?
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I'm sure the industry will find its way in the same way that, you know, everyone was, you know, was the crunch point when with all the Napsters and Kazars, and suddenly, you know, the pirate generation of the 2000s, that was seen as a massive danger for the industry. You know, yeah. Highly complicated, but we'll leave it there and we'll leave you guys reeling as we roll you out of our house, out the door. There was nothing in the lemonade. It was just the sheer complexity and waffliness of the topic that has addled your head. Maybe you'll come back for another time and, you know, yeah, please come back. We'll be here. We'll be chatting about something. But until then, I'm going to shut the door in your face.